It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can't pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
The subject of today's worship associate is theological mistakes. Now, those of us who were raised in a Judeo-Christian household were told at an early age that God created the universe, including the earth and all its beings. I had no concept of the Big Bang when I was a young boy, but it occurred to me and many of my friends and classmates, then who created God? Well, we were told that God existed forever. I think this was the origin of what came first, the chicken or the egg. Now, let me give you a little bit of my background so you know where I'm coming from. I was born and raised in Argentina, where there was no separation of church and state. The Constitution required that the president be Catholic, if only nominally. There was no divorce. Abortion was illegal, but widely practiced in private hospitals for middle-class people and back alleys for those who were not so fortunate. But the worst part of all was religion. Catholic religion was taught in all public schools. In every class, there were three or four young boys, this was an all-boys school that I went to, who were either Protestant, Jewish, or atheist, and they were herded to another classroom where they were taught a course entitled Ethics and Morals. That was the first time I noticed that morals could not be legislated. This course of ethics and morals was also taught by Catholic teachers in a course heavily tainted with Catholic dogma. Now, it doesn't take very long for us young boys to end up detesting the clergy, present company accepted. My mother was a very devout Catholic, and my father was an agnostic, or at least a non-practicing Protestant, his parents, my grandparents, being French Calvinists. Both I and my brother seemed to have inherited my father's genes rather than my mother's teachings. As I went on to college, I remember talking with two of my classmates about something more elaborate than the chicken and the egg argument. This time it was about the omnis that God was, omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, and more absurdities came to view. If God was omnibenevolent, why was there war and famine? Why were children born with severe congenital defects? Why did a young mother die of cancer or a young father die in an accident, leaving their children orphaned? That list could go on and on. Then came this omniscient thing. That was supposed to mean that God knew what everyone was doing because, as Catholic dogma taught us, everything was in the present for him. Now, if everything was in the present, why is he always depicted as an old man? I wonder why couldn't he have chosen eternal youth? That, of course, that he, or she, as the case may be, knew what we would do the next minute, the next day, or the next year. That was another conundrum. If she knew what we would do, then there was no free will. Our entire future was preordained, just as the past could not be changed, neither could the future. Well, it turns out that we were not wrong, or at least someone with far more knowledge of these things came to the rescue. This little book, entitled Omnipotence and Other Theological Mistakes, written by none other than Charles Hartshorne. Many of you knew Charles Hartshorne, but those of you who joined the church in 1999 or later, let me tell you about this giant of a man who was only 5'2". He used to sit there in the fourth row, right there where you are sitting, Klondike. That's hallowed ground, but just be a good boy and you can remain there. Charles was Harvard-educated professor of philosophy, first at the University of Chicago, then at Emory University, and finally at the University of Texas here in Austin. He died in October of the year 2000 at the age of 103. For the last year and a half of his life, he was very frail and unable to come to the church, so that's why many of you who joined the church later did not get to know him. He used to say he wanted to be the first philosopher to have lived in 3 centuries and 2 millennia, and he missed that goal by less than 3 months. He wrote or co-authored 20 books and more than 100 articles, the last one when he was 99 years old. Most of the books are way over my head. This is the only one that he claims to have written for the layman, and you have to be very careful when you read it. Just to give you an idea of the measure of this man, when he died, the obituary in the New York Times took a quarter of a page. Same thing was true for the San Francisco Chronicle, the Chicago Tribune, and even our local newspaper had about a half a page in his obituary. That's why I can't go into all the details of why all these omnis made absolutely no sense. As a matter of fact, Charles also used to say that he knew that Plato was wrong and that he was right. But I feel vindicated after all these years.
Now, in the center of our service and the center of our lives, let us make room to honor the quiet moments of life. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly remembering who you are and why you are here. In so many ways, our world seems divided between those who are alive and those who are afraid. We know those styles of being afraid and being alive, and we know how the first suffocates the second. We know well, even intimately. Let us remember that persistent optimism can break through the most rigid obstacles, just as tender green blades of grass will eventually crumble even concrete. Let us remember that trust is more empowering than suspicion, and that almost all people can be trusted if we will see them as our brothers and sisters rather than as disposable people to be dominated. Let us be witnesses and workers for a world in which fear's insidiousness is overcome by the persistent optimism of faith, hope, love, and work, given force by people who have come alive. Amen. A sermon title like Spiritual Aeronautics is such an ambitious name, it could almost cover a year's worth of classes in religion. What I'm really trying to work with in these 2 weeks is a lot smaller. It's the idea of salvation through understanding, wholeness through insight and integration. That's really at the heart of so much liberal religion all over the world. There are other paths. There are paths of devotion and silence, which we try to honor with candles, which Hindus have named their bhakti yoga. There are paths of action and service, or karma yoga. There are paths of meditation, of trying to find an insight into your own soul's divine nature, or raja yoga. There are other paths that are just as elegant. But the path at the center of most liberal religion, and certainly most Unitarian religions, is the path of trying to become more whole through understanding more fully. I'm concerned with what do we think we believe and what kind of coherence do those beliefs have in our life and the world that we're living in, or honest religion. One wonderful and bold rule in the study of religion that I learned a couple decades ago comes from this approach to religion, which is also the approach that universities take, graduate schools take. The rule is that the first word in religion should always be no. just like Mother said. No to the nonsense. No to the superstition. No to the empty jargon. No to the pointless recitations and idiosyncratic beliefs that we tend to exalt as though they had an authority from beyond us. And when I hear stories, like the story Henry told about his school experiences in Argentina, I always think the students who said no were more serious about religion than the pious priests were by chanting old statements whose meaning and relevance to life they could not have begun to unpack. In terms from last week's sermon, they were giving the students a set of fully packed luggage, packed for a trip in which Henry was not interested. Many of you can relate to this business of having been given fully packed religious luggage for a trip that you weren't interested in taking. Those stories always irritate me, because the best religious teachers in any tradition have always said no to this kind of nonsense, no matter how often it's packaged for takeout by the masses of their religion. It's like the Greek image I used last week of spiritual growth as the metamorphosis from a caterpillar to a butterfly. I really like that image. So I was momentarily disturbed when, after the service last Sunday, Hannah came out to the line. She was nearly cackling with glee as she told me, "I hate to burst your bubble, but only 2% of caterpillars become butterflies. The rest all get eaten." Okay, I hadn't thought of that. I figured some of them might get eaten, but not 49 out of 50. But I'm not going to give up a favorite metaphor that easily. In fact, I've decided that this new information just makes the metaphor that much better. For significant spiritual growth is hard, and not many want to do it. And one reason that so many spiritual caterpillars never become butterflies is precisely because they are eaten by doubt, by fear, or by intimidation. Henry's concern with theological mistakes or literalisms in a field that is only useful when it's poetic, this has happened in all ages. A second century Christian thinker who I've liked sometimes and don't like sometimes, a man named Tertullian, once said that people hated Christianity because they were ignorant of it, and when they stopped being ignorant, they would stop hating it. I've always loved the sense of that. But then Tertullian also said on one of his off days, and is more famous for asking, "What has Athens to do with Jerusalem?" Athens meant the philosophy, the culture, and the education of the Greeks. Jerusalem meant the Christian faith. And his answer was, "Knowledge has nothing at all to do with belief." It's hard to combine those two statements. And what Tertullian was really demanding was not, after all, understanding, but obedience. But religion's mostly been taught so poorly, especially in church-sponsored schools, that I think it has helped keep people ignorant. And I think that's a sin. Almost every great religious thinker has written against the dumbing down of religion. These aren't critiques from outside religion, they're critiques from inside of it. Almost every great religious thinker has written against the fact that religion is treated like caterpillar food, when it's meant to help people learn spiritual flight. Many early church fathers protested, and throughout the centuries, the best religious thinkers have attacked the versions of Christianity that were like religion for caterpillars. That's why I liked studying them. In the 19th century, one of my very favorites, and certainly one of the most acerbic and acidic, the Danish existentialist Soren Kierkegaard wrote a wonderful piece on this, using the image not of caterpillars, but of geese. Suppose, he said, suppose that the geese had their own religion. And then, of course, they would have gander preachers. And on Sunday, the geese would waddle into the church and they would sit attentively while the gander preacher preached about the noble destiny for which the Creator, and here the geese would curtsy and the ganders would bow the head, for which the Creator had intended geese through the gift of wings. And what a noble destiny it was that the geese could fly and soar high above the earth. And throughout the service, the geese and the ganders would nod and smile contentedly. And at the end of the service, they would waddle home talking about, again, what a wonderful sermon it was. And the next week, back to church for another variation on the same sermon. And again, they would waddle home. And once in a while, they would talk about the terrible things that befell a goose who actually tried to fly. What an unwise and risky thing it is. And then they would wander back to church. And once in a while, one of the geese, unfortunately, would take it all far too seriously and become depressed and morose and thin. And the rest would look and nod and say, "You see, that's what comes from taking these things seriously." And so it went until, of course, they grew fatter and fatter, and finally on Martinmas Eve, they were all eaten for dinner. And you see, they're so much like us. For man, too, has been given wings. Now that's Kierkegaard from over 150 years ago. It sounds so scathing that local newspapers would probably not print it today. And it's written by one of the greatest thinkers of Christianity. Wonderful. Both Kierkegaard's geese and the ancient Greek caterpillars were creatures that clung to the ground rather than rising to their high calling of flight or spiritual flight. In some ways, I think this notion of clinging to the ground is something that's deep in our culture. It was even in the responsive reading today, a reading about doubt that still wants to stand on a rock. I think in some ways it comes from the Bible, in the saying attributed to Jesus, which Jesus never said, that Peter was the rock on which he would build his church. Jesus never said this. It's a pun for first. The word for Peter in Aramaic was the same word as the word for rock. And it also was in Greek. It's where we get things like petroleum that comes from under the rocks. So first, it was a pun. Second, Jesus never came to found a church. And third, of all of his disciples, Peter was the one above all the rest who never got it. If you know the Bible, you know that Jesus' most hostile utterance in the Bible was given to Peter. When Peter didn't understand, and Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you think as men do, not as God does." Still, there's that notion of a rock, and the idea that we're supposed to stand on a rock and build on a rock. Another writer who has done so much with this, and it's a long story, so I'll just kind of allude to it, is a wonderful essay by Dostoevsky in the 19th century. It's from his book, The Brothers Karamazov, and it's a little essay in there called The Grand Inquisitor. And here, just like Kierkegaard, and making the same point with different images, Dostoevsky stages the amazing, audacious scene where Jesus decides to come back for a second coming during the Inquisition. in the 16th century. And so the Grand Inquisitor is talking to Jesus. He doesn't let Jesus speak, of course. He just tells him where it is. And he tells him what a fool he was for coming back, because in the morning the Inquisitor will have him burned. And then he blames him for creating such a high, hard religion that only the very, very few could ever aspire to it. He said, "You, for you it was easy." He said, "You're a son of God." He said, "How many others could do that? What of all the others who, though they love you, cling to their ignorance and their fear?" He said, "The church, you see, is to save them. We give them magic and mystery and authority, and they thank us for it. And you come back now and you would upset it just as you did the first time. And we can't allow it." So here's a cynical definition of religion for caterpillars. These aren't new critiques. They're old and they're powerful and they're wonderful to read. Nearly all of the better religious thinkers have always spoken against low-level or literal religion in favor of the higher kind. But that picture of the rock of ages, has been a central part of literal versions of Christianity and really of our culture forever. It's the image of adding creeds and other beliefs to that rock, more rocks, piling rocks on rocks until you build a kind of a mountain. And then the idea is that if you just stand firm on top of that mountain, you'll be safe. That's the religion Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor defended as what the church offered to the 98% who weren't up for spiritual teachings. It's a horrible, horrible betrayal of faith. There have always been those who use the concept of God to empower the church and rulers and to frighten the people into obedience rather than empowerment, and it's always a sin. It's telling and typical that as soon as the man Jesus died, Peter engaged in and finally won a vicious power struggle with Mary Magdalene, fairly well documented in some of the other Gospels discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls. A vicious power struggle with Mary Magdalene, who he said should be put away because women don't deserve life. A power struggle to define what kind of a religion would be built on the name of Jesus. And he won. Like Kierkegaard's geese, he seemed afraid of those who actually flew. Those who founded the religion about Jesus founded it often for the 98% who get eaten alive by doubt and fear and intimidation. And there's something deeply wrong there. I think it's a move of faithlessness that Jesus never showed. For he believed the power and the wisdom that we need is here, free, unmediated for us now. And the worst kind of faithlessness is the belief that the truth will be bad. Any religion based in fear, trying to save you, give you a rock to stand on, is a religion made to empower the leaders of a church and the empire at the expense of ordinary believers. Jesus would have hated it. Since the discovery of the Gnostic Gospels in 1945, we have so many more Gospels that give us such a different understanding of Jesus' teachings than traditional Christianity has taught. One of the most pointed and revealing, though there are many, comes from the Gospel of Thomas, probably written in the 50s or a couple decades before the first canonical Gospel was written. Here Jesus said, and see how different this sounds, see what a different religion this is. Here Jesus says, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you." There's a powerful religion. The real Jesus never spoke of sin and repentance. He spoke of illusion and enlightenment, of growing from simple to mature awareness. That's what honest religion is about, awareness and enlightenment, not memorization or obedience. In graduate school, I got to work with some wonderful teachers and some wonderful theologians who were also honest. It was a revelation to me that those two things could go together. Theologians who seemed to use their faith to fly by rather than to crawl with. I remember talking with one of my teachers, a Catholic theologian named David Tracy. He's still one of the leading thinkers in Roman Catholic thought. He once defined Christianity as his myth. I asked him what he meant by that. I said it sounded like he was saying that he knew Christianity was a fiction. Of course it's a fiction, he said. It's a profound and useful fiction. For him, even a necessary and an ultimate fiction. It contained the myths and the stories within which he chose to live and to define himself. And those stories let him rise above where he would be without such imaginative myths. Of course it's a fiction. The most important fiction in the world. I remember being surprised. I thought there was some kind of a law against theologians being honest. I think now that this may be the turning point that marks a caterpillar becoming a butterfly or a goose taking flight. The ability to hold lightly to one's beliefs. To understand that they're not true the way rocks are true. They're true the way really good stories are true. But doubt, fear, intimidation from family or friends can eat you alive, can pick you off like a caterpillar. Many beliefs can be adequate, but only if you own them rather than being owned by them, I think. Maybe flying means rising above beliefs, knowing they're useful fictions and using them, holding lightly to them, like theologians who call their religion their necessary fiction. Buddhists sometimes speak of beliefs as a raft that you use to cross a particular rough patch of water. And you can be grateful to the raft for getting you across the water. But then they say the wrong thing to do with the raft would be to pick it up and carry it on your back for the rest of your life out of gratitude for getting you across a rough patch of water. They said the next thing you need to get across may not require a raft. It may require a ladder. Put the raft down and get on with your journey. Others have talked about beliefs as a ladder that gets you to a certain height so you can see better. But once you've seen more clearly, they say remember not to worship the ladder, but to set it aside and go on. Because the next thing you need may not be a ladder. Maybe it'll be a raft. And you can't pick the raft up if you've got the ladder on your back. Maybe fixed beliefs, rigid and intransigent, certain and hard as rocks, are the caterpillar stage of religion. And the butterfly stage is the ability to hold lightly to them, knowing that life itself somehow sustains us, that life is bigger than beliefs, and that all will be well. Or remember that wonderful saying from Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas, that if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. And if you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. You see how all this comes together? Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor is defending a religion of superstition and fear that Henry and millions of students had taught, and so many others here have had taught in different ways and different places. Orthodoxy, I think, is a religion made of rocks, piled on each other to make a mountain on which it is safe to stand. That's a religion for caterpillars, but it's also a terrible misuse of a mountain. I can imagine what Kierkegaard would do with the image of his geese all standing on top of a mountain, just standing there. How he'd be saying, look, you're already in the sky. Just stick your wings out. The wind will pick you up. Trust. One of the most important religious lessons is that the highest religious faculty, this is very hard to learn, even to believe, the highest religious faculty is not memorization, but imagination. Not obedience, but awareness. We have to help shape the gods we will serve. We have to help provide nuance for our necessary fictions. I think again of my teacher and friend David Tracy's wonderful definition of Christianity as his myth, his ultimate fiction. That's using beliefs in the right way as tools to help you bring forth what is within you, rather than not bringing forth what is in you and being eaten alive by fear. And then all the rocks in the world can't save you. It's using beliefs as a launching pad for your spiritual flight rather than treating beliefs like a pile of rocks. I want to end with a story. I've told you almost nothing but stories so far. About religions of piles of rocks, about geese who refuse to fly, about caterpillars and butterflies. So I'll end with a story that I won't bother to interpret for you. It's adapted from a story I read in one of Rachel Naomi Riemann's wonderful books, a book called My Grandfather's Blessings. Riemann is a physician in the San Francisco area who works with primarily terminal patients and patients with extreme situations, because she has a wisdom and an insight that has other physicians constantly referring difficult cases to her. This story came from one of her patients, a woman who had spent her life striving for success, building a career that never fed her, and creating levels of stress that may have had something to do with the cancer she had. During treatments for her cancer, she re-examined her life, she saw it in a new way, and she had a kind of a revelation which came to her in a dream. I dreamed, she said, that I saw a woman building a mountain, rock by rock. She was building a mountain, piling innumerable heavy rocks on top of each other, climbing to the top and piling on more rocks as her mountain grew bigger and bigger and she ascended higher and higher. At last it was a truly magnificent mountain, rising high into the sky, covered in snow-capped peaks, impressive from any angle. And she stood there on top of her mountain of rocks, triumphant and alone. I marveled, she said, at what an amazing accomplishment it was, building a whole mountain and then ascending it, standing there on top with your arms stretched up to the sky. The woman, of course, was me, so I felt great pride watching this scene. But then something frightening and terrible happened. As I stood there atop the huge mountain, there suddenly appeared a large crack near the mountain's base. The mountain shook, the crack grew bigger, shot upward, and the whole mountain began collapsing in on itself. My feet slipped off the rock, and the rocks all began turning to dust and falling to earth. Then, she said, just as the whole irrelevant thing crumbled beneath me, I suddenly discovered that I could fly.